Radio 7 Costa Blanca met Patrick van Landegem.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
The ex-Beatles story. And in this program, we take a look at the separate careers of George and Ringo today. Turning first to George, whose major achievement must be the results of the concert for Bangladesh.
I'd just like to say before we start off with the concert that to thank you all for coming here. And as you all know, it's a special benefit concert. We've got a good show lined up, I hope so, anyway. I'd like to introduce you to a few people up here. Everybody here came at very short notice, and some people even cancelled a few gigs to try and make it, and nobody was getting paid for anything. We got on drums, Ringo Starr. Jim Keltner. There's somebody on bass who many people have heard about, but they never actually seen him. Klaus Voormann. We've got a whole lot of guitarists. Mr. Jesse Ed Davis. The old friend of mine, Mr. Eric Clapton.
And so the introductions went on, reading like a pop who's who. Then, of course, it was time for the music. First, a brilliant display by Ravi Shankar and his friends, and then George singing to this great rhythm accompaniment, Wah Wah.
Thank you.
Alan Klein, who produced the concert with George.
We just went out there to give him a show. You couldn't have put the show on, you know? I mean, the economics, if there were not going to be ancillary rights, if there was going to be no film and no record, that show costs, oh my God, don't ask. You know, but it didn't cost the charity anything. But the purpose was, if you're going to do it, you do it right. And cost is not a factor. And that's one of the reasons that if you have money, you can use it right, the proper use of money gives you power. And if you use that power well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's no different than the good use of political power.
The beauty of that concert was that it was all just so rushed and so spontaneous. And once you get into planning like a tour, or we're going to do this, we're going to do that, loses the appeal. Like, I don't really want to go back into doing what we did all those years on the road, motels and bad food and traveling and all that noise and aggravation. I mean, I wouldn't mind doing selective concerts now and then, and I mean, I miss playing.
Yeah.
Because you know, that's a problem. It's nice to feel that you're doing, singing a few songs, and people are there enjoying it.
I won't do it when you're high. I don't understand what's wrong.
The tumultuous applause in the Madison Square Garden at the end of the concert for the relief of Bangladesh. The sales from the soundtrack album are now approaching $10 million, and it's predicted that the final sales and profits from admission to the film will further enrich the fund to something like $15 million. George Harrison, Ravi Shankar and Alan Klein were presented with the Child is the Father of the Man award by UNICEF because of the results of that Bangladesh concert. Single track from George's LP, Living in the Material World, from which George's publishing profits are donated to the Material World Charitable Foundation. Now, the LP, whilst good, was not all that different in direction from the triple LP set All Things Must Pass, and as we mentioned in the context of Paul's career, some of the critics were quick to leap in and put it down.
Thank you.
And that's where we leave the career of George Harrison, who may well be on the brink of a whole new career, having signed a production contract with Atlantic Records. Our last ex-Beatle is, of course, Ringo, and his career's taken on a different aspect. His film, Blind Man, ran into trouble with the British Film Censor, and since then he's become more involved as a director of Apple Films and with the production of films. At the Cannes Film Festival in May 72, he talked to Sonia Beasley.
It started out where I was trying to get all the old sort of faith healers, country healers in Britain. I wanted to document them because I think they're dying out and there'll be no more, you know, with, you know, the cure warts on cows or wherever, you know. All the old farmers who can really cure things and they whisper to horses and things like that, which is, it's dying out. It's, that race is just disappearing. And I got some people together and we went out to try and find out about them, but they wouldn't be filmed because they said it was bad for the powers. You know, it would take the power away from them, so that fell through. Then I thought, okay, well, we'll try some films and documentaries.
And now you've got the taste, you're going to go on making films.
Well, this year I'm forcing myself to go into the office every day. It's not bad in the winter, but when the sun's shining, it gets a bit heavy.
But is this really you, Ringo? I mean, being a sort of behind scenes, masterminding it all, instead of being up there in front of the cameras?
Well, yes, it's all me, you know. I enjoy being in front of them. That's easier. This is much harder because I spend every day talking to people to try and get them involved in what I'm doing. You know, I need directors. I don't do everything. I've just got together a director for a feature film we're going to do. But, you know, I had to talk to like 5 directors, and some of them hated the idea of the story. Some of them liked it. Some of them couldn't get out of the commitments they were in. You have to talk to writers. I mean, you just talk to people every day, and people knock on the door every day saying, I've got this script, you know, I'd like you to do it, or whatever. So you see everybody. And you know, you just decide what you want to do, then you've got to get it together. And I don't mind it. We have some good times and some bad times, but it's, on the whole, it's usually good.
So why have you decided to take the hard way, as it were? I mean, you could sit back
because
and make the odd...
Because I don't know how to do it, and I thought, I'll try it and see what it's like. So I've given myself a year, and I may hate it at the end of the year, and then I won't do it anymore. I'll go back on the other side.
But you like
but
the
I
challenge.
Like doing it all. It's interesting to find out, you know, that you think it's easy. You know, it's like people watch a movie for an hour and a half, which I do, and it's true, it's what you should do. You think, oh, it only took them an hour and a half to make. You know, I mean, I watch a film, and it's reality. It took the film takes an hour and a half from beginning to end, and that's all I listen, you know. I'm not interested in rehearsals and hassles and all that when I watch the product. But a lot goes on that you have to sort out, you know.
And after he recorded that interview, Ringo spent time directing his film Born to Boogie, all about Mark Bolan and the ballyhoo surrounding the success of T-Rex.
May do a bit of his poetry, which has never been out. You know, he's never done that before. We've got a few sketches we're going to do. It's like the Tom Jones Show, in fact. Not really, folks. Just joshing.
When that was premiered in December, Ringo and Mark Bolan were both mobbed in scenes reminiscent of the early days of Beatlemania. Quite apart from all the celluloid activity, he had a very big hit record.
Here we go, Back Off Boogaloo, by your friend and mine, Ringo.
I'm gonna do, I gotta fly high, just right from the start.
Back Off Boogaloo by Ringo, produced by George Harrison, which made the number 2 spot in the UK and number 9 in the USA. Well, since then, Ringo's completed a highly successful album called Ringo, which he made with a little help from a lot of friends. And I asked him how he managed to assemble them all.
Well, what's amazing, you see, Brian, is that a phone call and you get a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of friends all over the world, and you can just... We were in LA and all those people are around, and we called them and said, would you? And they said, yeah, you know, bar for 6 o'clock in the morning, which we did in England, which was Paul's, which mm-hmm. after John and George had written a song for me, I asked him, would he like to write one?
Mm-hmm.
Or if he had one. And we did that one here.
And you got
to... Just because they're all nice people.
Yeah. And also of interest, I'm sure, to pretty well everybody, is that all four Beatles are on the album in various tracks.
Yeah, it caused a lot of problems, though, you see. As soon as the album came out, there was all this stuff about, are they getting together and all that, but which wasn't strictly true. It was just that they still are my friends, each other's friends. And I asked them to do something for me, and they did it. You know.
But never all together in any one track, of course.
No, the closest is I'm the Greatest on the first track, which is John, George and I, which is really weird when we did it. Because we were three of us sitting in the studio looking at each other, smiling, saying, oh, you know, it's just nothing that could be said, but it's not television, so you can't see my face. But we were just looking at each other and smiling because the three of us were together, you know, it was just a good experience.
When I was a little boy, way back home in Liverpool, was great. Then when I was a teenager, I knew that I had got something going. All my friends told me I was great.
I'm the Greatest, from the latest hit album from Ringo Starr.
Radio 7 Costa Blanca, el sol de tu radio.
The four boys who grew up together in Liverpool in the 50s and formed the world's greatest group are now independently successful men. As George Martin, their record producer, said of them, The world was probably a good deal happier for their music and should be grateful that these people did come together at this time. Just to round off the series, we thought it might be interesting to hear what some of the other superstars of the 70s think of the Beatles today. First, we asked Elton John.
Well, since the breakup, I suppose, I think John's come up with the best album out of anybody, probably, with Imagine. I liked Imagine because it didn't have any of Yoko Ono on it. I suppose that's my personal opinion. George, I really liked All Things Must Pass. I thought it was really great, and I think it surprised a lot of people. I think George is far cleverer than people think. McCartney's probably the most sort of talking point. As a talking point, he's probably talked about more than anyone else because people have been really disappointed critically. He hasn't come up with anything as good as the stuff he did on the Beatles album. I really like Ram. I thought the first album he made was all right. But, you know, there's a couple of nice songs on it. Ram I quite liked after hearing it about 150 times. I quite liked it. Again, I'd rather hear Paul McCartney rather than Linda McCartney. You know, I still think he's going to come through with an ace hand. I think he's incredibly talented. And he's got so much melody in his head. He's going to come up with his best album yet. And I think, you know, that's something real worth looking forward to, really. Ringo's lovely. He makes great little singles. He made an album called Boku Blues, which I really liked, country album, which I thought was very nice. And he does lots of sessions. He appears on lots of people's albums. I think Ringo's just happy zonking away on the drums. I think he's more into it as a drummer now than he's ever been. It's very hard because they're brilliant. They're all of them brilliant in what they do, and I'd love to see them make an album together again. I think everybody would, really. But there you go.
Then Mick Jagger was asked what he thought of them today.
I don't care anymore about what they do as a group. I mean, I care about what they do. I mean, it doesn't worry me if they ever come back together again or not. I mean, I just wish them the best of luck and that, and what they've done is great, you know. But I mean, they're not the force in music that they were, and they just ain't anymore. And, you know, and nor is Bob Dylan. They seem to be like the Beatles and Dylan and us, you know. And we were all doing our own bits, you know, and it all fitted all right, you know what I mean? Because it didn't matter if we just did our little bit, which was just like ordinary, straight rock and roll. And then there was Dylan to do his things, and then... And it sort of covered quite a wide range, you know. But now those other two people just don't seem to be doing it. That's it, just getting old, I suppose they are. Like a rolling stone. Like a rolling stone, like the FBI and the CIA and the BBC.
And it was Neil Diamond who provided the most eloquent assessment of the Beatles' achievements to date.
What they did was they exposed the composer, the writer, to prominence. They said that writers are important, and from that point on, the writer became, to me, the most important commodity. up until then, writers were second-class citizens in the music business. The artist was primary. They made it acceptable as well for artists to go into a recording studio independent of any kind of controls from the record company, because essentially what the Beatles proved was that you could not only do things that were artistic, but things that were commercially saleable, which is what a record company is primarily interested in. They did Sgt. Pepper, and they proved it to everybody. From that point on, at least from what I felt in the States, there was a tremendous change of attitude among record companies. They were more open to experiment, and they were more open to permitting artists to do what they did, and they lost fortunes of money in that respect. but I think it's upgraded the entire music industry and the quality of the music that's been written and been recorded. I don't think there's any question about that. And to me, that is the debt that I owe to them, aside from them giving everybody beautiful, beautiful music.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key, stepping outside, she is free. We gave her most of our lives, is leaving, sacrificed most of our lives. We gave her everything money could buy. Snores as his wife gets into her dressing gown, picks up the letter that's lying there, standing alone at the top of the stairs. She breaks down and cries to her husband, "Daddy, our baby's gone." Why would she treat us so thoughtlessly? How could she do this to me? We never thought of ourselves, never a thought for ourselves. We struggled hard all our lives to get by. She's leaving far away, waiting to keep the appointment she made, meeting a man from the motor trade. What did we do that was wrong?
One final example of that beautiful music Neil Diamond spoke of there, She's Leaving Home, from Sgt. Pepper. And now, though the Beatles no longer exist, their influence has extended to a whole new generation of pop idols. David Cassidy, for instance.
Well, I liked them. I mean, it was at a time when I was really influenced a lot by their music, you know. I think that the Beatles wrote the soundtrack really to my youth, mm-hmm. you know, they really yeah. did.
For one more word, we turn to writer-composer Roger Greenaway.
Their stature is still, you know, to me, they're the greatest things that ever happened to show business. And I can't see anything in the next 50 years ever emulating what they have done. I think their songs in 50 years' time will still be as popular as they are today. In fact, there's people who I respect and I've met in America, people like Mitchell Parrish, who the great all-time writers, he wrote them, and Hoagy Carmichael, they wrote Stardust, which is like the most recorded song ever. And I feel in 50 years' time, one might be discussing the Beatles and the most recorded song ever, possibly something like Yesterday. And that's where they are. They're at the top. And I don't think anyone can ever take them away from the top because of their writing.
And that's where we end our story. Apple has reissued two double albums of all the Beatles' major hits, and to date, in the UK and America, they've sold something like 4 million copies, with more going like hotcakes every day. Perhaps in some small way, this series has helped a few fans, both old and new, to understand how it happened and what it was all about. And that's a lot from me, Brian Matthew, but we'll leave the last word of all to Paul, who was asked for his reaction to this production.
I thought it was incredible, actually, yeah. It was amazing. Because, I mean, after the things you hear about on there, when it's all put together in a big story, you know, you just, I didn't know half of the facts on it, you know. Just, I mean, you hear about what the publisher thought and what he thought and what the inside story of what he said, and it's quite interesting, I think, you know. You know, I'm glad it's all kind of capsuled like that, you know, and all put down, because it helps me, really. You know, it's as if that was it, you know, and it's finished now, folks. That's really why it wouldn't start up again, you know. It's been done, it's been covered, the obituary's been written, and it's been kind of laid to rest, you know, Beatles R.I.P. And it's now long live the individuals.